Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
You can't hide from anything out here. There's nothing. You have to deal with it. And when it's 40 below and the heater breaks, you have to deal with that.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about dealing with it, and the it is the Iditarod. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we drop everything and go dog mushing, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
This is our special Daylight Savings Time Adjusted Pushing Deadline Sunday edition of the pod. It happens every year. We have to spring forward with our clocks. We lose an hour of sleep. It doesn't really affect the Iditarod too much. The race clock itself is counted in days, hours, minutes, and seconds. That keeps inevitably marching on, as time tends to do. The sled dog teams are also generally on their own run-rest schedules, and that goes around the clock, sometimes more at night to get a firm trail in the relative cold. So the time change kind of affects the rest of us more, but it doesn't mean much in the grand scheme of things. What does matter is who is leading the 2019 Iditarod and whose teams comprise a dangerous chase pack. Girdwood musher Nicholas Petit's team left the Yukon River behind Saturday night, along with Bethel's Pete Kaiser, who had led into Caltag before him, but still had to complete an eight-hour rest. From there, though, wow. Nicholas Petit and his dogs mushed 90 miles overnight into Sunday morning, stopping, as far as I could tell from the Iditarod GPS tracker, something like 3 or 4 minutes along the way to get to Unalakleet, arriving about 9:45 Sunday morning. 90 miles, with a very short break, maybe for a snack. That is probably on a nice, firm trail overnight. Being colder at night, it's going to firm up, and probably they were just flying. It's still a very long run. Here is Team Petit arriving in Unalakleet. You look at Petit's runtime between Caltag and Unalakleet, it was a little under 11 hours. That's not the best of all time or anything like that, but it's faster right now as I'm looking at it than any of the top five mushers at the moment. To put this in perspective, I finished up with the podcast, went home, had dinner, watched a movie with my wife, went to bed, slept, you know, a reasonable amount of time, got up, had coffee, and saw Nick Petit getting into Unalakleet. He had left Caltag before all of that. It's kind of incredible. They're out there mushing all night long, just pushing on through. And that might be the kind of move that Petit needed to make to force everybody else to come chase him. He did a long run. His dogs looked really good coming into Unalakleet. From the Iditarod Insider videos, they looked happy. Here is another minute or so of Nick Petit and Unalakleet reporters asking him a few different questions.
Nick, thoughts on your run in and how your team looks coming in here? They look pretty strong.
Yeah, they look great. They're doing good. Even the yearling seemed like he was having fun the whole time. So, that's, yeah, doing good.
What was the trail like coming in? It reports that it was pretty fast.
It was fast, and then it was slow, a little bit slow, and then it was fast. You know, just like at most trails. It changes as you go.
You impressed with your dog team at this point so far?
Yeah, I'm happy with it.
Yeah. Nick, why did you decide to stop in Unalakleet for a rest?
Well, you gotta stop somewhere. And I thought of going up the hills with the camp and all that, but I would have to camp on the way here to do that. I'm not gonna go through here and then try to go up the hill. The dogs really wanted to take the normal turn in here. And after the normal turn, the one that like all of them but the yearning have been here. And they were like, where are we going? So we were going here.
Which dogs led you into Unalakleet today?
Shubi and Jeffrey, just like last year.
Shubi and Jeffrey?
Yeah.
How old are they?
on Jeffrey's 5 and Shuby's 4.
Have they been leading most of the race?
Yeah, a good part.
Definitely, you know, got a much needed rest there. And then everybody else who's in the top 4, really. We talk about the top 5 because that's a nice round number, but it's the top 4 right now that I'm looking at, because you've got Petit out there in first. He's a ways ahead of the chase pack. And then from there, it's Pete Kaiser, Jesse Royer, and the defending champ, Yor Lifseth Olsom. Those guys all just stayed long enough in Unalakleet to check in. They got back on the trail just a little less than 2 hours behind Petit. Mentioned Pete Kaiser a second ago. He's having a great race. He and his dogs really are contributing to a very competitive Iditarod this year. Here's a quick clip of Pete passing through Unalakleet and trying to catch up with Nick Petit. Pete's dad was on KYUK radio out of Bethel just recently with Jessica Klaika's mom. She's a rookie in this year's race. And we're going to hear more from their parents here in a minute. Klaika is just one of the Yukon-Kuskokwim area rookies in this year's Iditarod. And those YK mushers like Pete Kaiser, they're no strangers to the rough trails, the warm, wet weather we've seen in the midsection of this year's race. We heard from Jessica Klaika in Shagalek as she completed her 8-hour rest. She described the run into Iditarod, the checkpoint of Iditarod, as a wild experience.
But it was a couple hours of straight tundra tussocks, big, huge tussocks, no snow, huge holes, and just pushing our sled over them.
It sounds like that's a familiar feeling from fall training in Bethel, which involves runs over the tundra, while low snow years mean overland trails are full of unexpected bumps and icy patches. Klaika says her technique was to drive cautiously, but slowing the team down also brings its own complications.
Because if you use your brake, it's going to get stuck on the tundra tussock. And then if you're using your drag, your foot is like bouncing all over the place. But I tried to keep them super, super slow so they could figure out where to go. But I'm sure they still think that we probably went too quickly through that area. The dogs, they were trying to find their footing.
Besides a sore knee from earlier in the Dalzell Gorge, Klaika physically made it out okay. But before her break was up, she took some time to double-check all of the joints on her sled.
Checkers in Iditarod were like, okay, what'd you break on your sled? Because everybody's broken something. And surprisingly, my sled's holding up really well. I'm going to go check the bolts and make sure that nothing's loose from being rattled for hours.
Nicholas Wickstrand, another rookie from the YK area, has been running dogs a few years with Kaiser's kennel. He, too, was trying to take things a little slower over the tussocks to avoid risking any injuries.
Because they have to lift their feet and really watch where they're going. And I think that's also a little mentally tiring for them to concentrate on where to step all the time. So I saw it as I got closer to Iditarod that my leader started fumbling around. But that could also be the lack of a trail.
It actually rained Friday in Shagalek as the temperatures climbed into the 30s. There was warm, gusty wind blowing straw and dog bowls across the dog lot. Wickstrand was unfazed by all these marginal conditions.
Our dogs are kind of used to this warm temperature now, since in Bethel where we train it's been above freezing for 1.5 months almost. So the dogs are used to it, so you only have to give them enough water, and this seems to drink plain water and kibble really well, but I try to sneak in some meat as well, and then they usually stop eating, or they eat less at that point.
There's a third YK Delta rookie musher, that's Victoria Hardwick, who arrived at the halfway point of Iditarod on Saturday afternoon, and at last check, Hardwick was bringing up the rear in 48th place. That is 48 mushers, because we've had some scratches actually at the Iditarod checkpoint. Emily Maxwell, Marcel Fresneau, and Cindy Abbott scratched, and then Shaney Traska had dropped out in Nikolai earlier. So we heard from Jessica Klaika, Nick Wickstrand, and mentioned Pete Kaiser, and we talked to all of these mushers in the Iditarod, but what about the parents who are left behind? Do they call their mushing kids while they're out on the trail?
Have not. I don't call him. Okay. That's for sure. I don't try that.
Same thing here.
No news is good news.
Exactly.
That's Ron Kaiser and Jackie Klaika calling in to KYUK Radio in Bethel. Each of them has a child in the Iditarod, but it's Ron Kaiser who has been here many times before. He doesn't try to call his son Pete while he's racing. He says the Iditarod GPS tracker has become his best friend, but it's also where he goes to watch and worry.
I did take my anxiety medication. Yeah, that's what being a dad of an Iditarod musher is. Sort of, it's a lot of anxiety and wondering, you know, what's happening.
Ron hit it on the nose. It's a little anxious. My rest-sleep schedule is totally out the window. That's why I have the coffee right now. I was up late, of course, last night trying to watch her on the tracker.
Bethel veterinarian Jackie Klaka is not new to mushing, but this is the first time she's had a kid in the Iditarod. She, too, is keeping a close eye on the tracker and not calling Jessica on her rookie run up the trail to Nome.
You know, you get to a point where you go, oh, I just want to see him get through this spot. So I actually stayed up last night just doodling a little bit here with some art. And I drew a picture of Jessica with her dogs, and then I went ahead and painted it. I stayed up so late.
And if she was checking in on her daughter here Sunday night, she'd see that Jessica is in 36th place. That is third out of the 10 rookies still in the Iditarod. And that is not bad. I'm sure her mom will be rooting for her all the way to Nome, as well as many people out in the YK Delta region. Well, we've said this before. The theme of this year's pod is fun and friendship. And we've now added family to the fun and friendship. So fun, friendship, and family now. And bear with me here for a second. Because the race has reached the coast, with the front of the pack teams already starting in on a route that's going to avoid any of the usual travel over sea ice. That's because where the Iditarod Trail usually goes, the ice is, how do we say this? It's not frozen in the rapidly warming Arctic and subarctic. Okay, back to fun, family, and friendship. Here is the sister of our trail reporter, Ben Matheson.
Hey guys, this is Leah from Minnesota. I've really been enjoying the podcast and learning more about the Iditarod. Can you talk about how climate change has affected the Iditarod in recent years?
The most dramatic warm weather effect we've seen is that the race has been moved three times to start a few hundred miles north of Willow in Fairbanks. Two of those times were within the last 5 years. And the main reason is that if there's not enough snow, it's too dangerous to drive dogs through some parts of the trail, and mushers have gotten hurt in the really rough years. You can think broken ankles and concussions. One of the race's most iconic and sometimes challenging sections of trail runs over the frozen ocean from Shaktulik to Koyuk, but the sea ice has been a lot less consistent or sometimes even not there. This year, the trail is expected to hug the shore between the two checkpoints after most of the ice has moved out. We've also seen a lot of races that have been canceled due to bad trails. These shorter races are often qualifier races that mushers must do to be able to run the full race. Thanks for the great question, Leah.
I love how Ben doesn't even acknowledge that that's his sister. He just gives us the answer. We love getting these listener questions, whether they're from family, friend, or foe. You can send those to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And as always, you can send the question in your own voice. Most smartphones have a voice memo app. You can open that up, record yourself asking the question, and then send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. We will do our best to get those answered. Really appreciate all the questions that we've gotten so far. Also, if you want to hear more of Ben's stories from the trail, like if you're a family member, his sister, mom, you want to know how he's getting along, or just a friend, or you want to know how our other trail reporter, Alaska Public Media, Zachariah Hughes, shout out to the Zach fam. We posted a conversation between those two guys in Unalakleet. It even mentions a slight emergency-ish landing for our pilot Rob. That is posted on the podcast. You can listen to that now. I also heard from Quince Mountain from McGrath, still trying to catch up with the race, looking to post that sometime. For now, we're going to hear part of a different extended interview, and we're going to hear the first half or so of this conversation. This is an interview with Healy Denali area musher Kristen Knight Pace. She's a Yukon Quest and Iditarod veteran. Not running the Iditarod this year, but her husband Andy Pace ran the Yukon Quest. And she has a book out. It's called This Much Country. We talked about the book a little bit. We talked about her life and what's in the book. She's 35 now, originally from Fort Worth, Texas, got a degree in photojournalism from University of Montana, is a former journalist, and was a National Outdoor Leadership School instructor, a Forest Service trail crew member. She's done a lot of work in the outdoors. And she tells us how she ended up in Alaska. Her husband, Andy, has a PhD in lyric poetry. So a former journalist and a poetry scholar together just kind of goes to show that all these mushers are all very different people, and you just can't really pin them down on being exactly one type of person. And as Kristen explains here, she had been doing a summer internship in Denali National Park working with the sled dog kennel there. There's actually a working kennel in Denali National Park, the only one in the Park Service. So that is kind of what her original connection to dog mushing in that area is. And she will explain here how that kind of took off. Here's Kristen Knight Pace.
So that was a summer job. And then I went back to Montana, worked for the newspaper, you know, had a relatively normal life with my husband there. Then he left. And so I was kind of floundering and I didn't really know what to do. And my friend Jess, who worked for the kennels up here and had worked with me that summer, called me and said, "Hey, I know you're going through a hard time. There's a guy up here who has a one-room cabin and a team of sled dogs, and he needs somebody to caretake them for the winter." And I said, "Okay, I'll be there in a month." So I drove up with my two dogs, Moose and Maximus, and my parents and my family were like, "You're going to go through a divorce in the coldest, darkest place in the world alone in a one-room cabin. Like, what are you thinking?" Yeah, that's kind of where that was the pivot point of making the leap. So I spent that whole winter alone with that dog team. And probably the most transformational thing was deciding to hook up that dog team one day. I didn't really know what I was doing. I'd been on that demo sled, you know, in the summertime on the gravel track. But like, that's not reality. So we took off out onto the tundra of the Stampede Corridor and they just took me on a ride. I didn't give them a single command. I didn't know where we were going. They brought me back home an hour later. And I just basically underwent this huge internal shift when that happened and realized that being alone was wonderful and that Alaska kind of wraps you into its folds and makes you, even though you're just this tiny inconsequential thing, makes you feel like an important part of that thing and that you're like a thrumming, living, breathing part of this beautiful world. I was like, I have to do this. The next winter, I got a job as one of the actual mushers for the Park Service. And the next winter, I worked for Jeff King as a handler, and I ran my first race. Andy and I got married in the handler cabin, and then we bought our first three puppies from Jeff and started our own kennel.
To take that leap from one life to another, it's a totally different thing to be a long-distance competitive musher, right?
Oh, man, a whole different world. And I had just volunteered on the Iditarod. I will never forget standing in that dog yard in Nikolai and watching the mushers come in. And I had just had this pretty epic season of mushing at the Park Service. And that's all in the book, but it's a very different kind of mushing. You need skills. You develop some serious skills. So
just out there in Denali National Park, basically mushing.
Yeah, with no trail. You know, yeah. There's no snow machines allowed out there. Yeah. So I remember standing there in that dog yard, Nikolai, watching the mushers take the booties off the dogs, you know, put them down in the straw, get all their food ready. And I was like, I can do that. And there's no reason why I shouldn't be the one out there. Like, I can do that, and I want to do that with my own dogs.
You write more about the races that you guys have run in the book. But this is the question I really want to ask you about the book. Different mushers have written different books about their experiences, how they got to Alaska, how they got into mushing. Oftentimes it involves stories of survival. But is this a story of survival in some ways, not necessarily just surviving out in the wilderness?
I think that the skills I learned that first winter here, like recovering from this massive heartbreak and being forced to deal with every emotion as it came up, totally prepared me to be a long-distance dog musher. Because you can't hide from anything out here, you know? And if it's you in a one-room cabin, what are you going to do to distract yourself from grief? You know, there's nothing. You have to deal with it. And when the water pump breaks, you have to deal with that too. And when it's 40 below and the heater breaks, you have to deal with that. And it was definitely survival that first winter and learning a ton of those valuable lessons, but that prepared me completely for dealing with everything that goes down on the trail that I outlined in my book. And there's a lot. And that's not even close to all of the stories. But the kind of overarching mantra that you have as the dog musher is, it's not going to get any better. You know, like if you're hungry, you're just going to get hungrier. So you have to stop and eat right now. If you're cold, you're just going to get colder. If your sled's broken, it's just going to get more broken if you don't stop and fix it. So, yeah, that laid the foundation for sure.
You and the dogs are the only ones that are going to get you out of this.
Yes. And it was the same way for healing from a divorce, too. Mm-hmm. Me and the dogs were the only ones that got us out of it.
Thanks to Kristen Knight Pace for coming in and talking about her book, This Much Country. The rest of that interview that you just heard, another half of it or so, is posted as an extended cut here on the iDidaPod. I want to thank her and Andy Pace for coming in, and it was great to see him and Ada as well. And as we've been recording all of this, Nicholas Petit has continued his march up the coast of Alaska. It looked like he was approaching the checkpoint of Shaktulik. And that is about all the time we have for today. We will be back with more race coverage, more stories from the trail. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Until next time, happy trails. Like, I refuse to read books that aren't signed.
Do you want me to tell you what it says?
Is it cryptic enough?
Yeah. Casey Grove, here's to your career change. Thank you for being an enduring part of Yukon Quest Trail lore. Kristen Pace.
Oh, thank you. I'll tell you. Thank you very much. Yeah.